Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, we're joined by a pair of special guests, Ryan McLean, the TAC Program Manager, and Major Steve McGee, Executive Officer of Marine Wing Communications Squadron 28. Thanks for joining us. Could you give us a quick intro?
Hey guys, my name is Ryan McLean. I lead the TAC Product Center, and we are the organization in the U.S. government that makes TAC available to the world.
And because we have a standing rule on this podcast, can you go ahead and define the acronym since you used it first? What is TAC?
TAC. Well, it depends on how you're using it. If you're using it in a Title 10
military role. Just define the acronym, Ryan. Just define the acronym.
All right. It's impossible.
Team Awareness Kit.
Ooh.
Team Awareness Kit if you're a civilian, or Tactical Assault Kit if you're a military person.
That definitely sounds
sexy. And we'll get into that.
Okay. All right. Steve, hit us.
So as John said, I'm the current executive officer for Marine Wing Clam Squadron 28. Whenever I was mentioned that, hey, we're going to talk about ATAC, I was enthusiastic. I want to be a part of the podcast. I don't know how much I will have to offer to the podcast, but like anything, when you're around magic, which I was operational, as was John, and you realize, because I've run the full gambit of billets across the Marine Corps, whether it was capability development or for SOCOM, you're like, holy smokes, they got it right. And I want to listen to the program manager, and I want to learn from them, because all hope is not lost for the Marine Corps. So I'm excited to be a part of this.
Awesome. And as a fellow Comp Squadron 28 Spartan in my past, you'll say, hoorah.
All three of us.
That's right. All three of us. That's right. I still have my Marine Corps ball glasses upstairs. They got broken out last week. I love it. All right. So guys, I want to kick us off on this one because we're talking about a very specific and nuanced and esoteric subject, mostly revolving around command and control. And I get to play the guy who's outside of the military now and has been for a while. And when we used to talk about C2, that old command and control, the only terrible scarring memory that floods into my brain is C2PC and the insanity that was C2PC. And so I want to you know, get into a point here where we're starting to contrast and compare a little bit of the old and the new, because I assume we're doing things very differently now, right? And knowing that Ryan and Steve, you two have never met, I'm interested to sort of understand how we want to approach this, because we want to really start breaking this podcast in particular down into two distinct parts. One, for the generic general audience member who goes, oh, C2 is command and control on this one. And then we're going to dive real deep on the back half of this for those who want to super duper geek out on software development and how it pertains to C2 and the TAC itself. So does that work for you both?
Sounds great.
Sounds awesome. I also want to call out really quick for the listeners at home that may not know, Ryan is truly getting expeditious on this podcast. He is taking this podcast from a car at night with the pouring rain. And I know you all can't see him right now, but it is some like rom-com level stuff happening at the moment where he's just making it work. And I appreciate you, Ryan.
Hey, all right. On Camp Pendleton, nonetheless.
On Pendleton.
I'm not going to be outdone. I'm going to grab my phone and start running.
Just running in the rain. That's it. Yeah. I'm just going to get PT in while we're doing this.
Run around the house.
Okay.
I mean, this is the definition of operational, is it not? I mean, doing comms on the move.
Exactly. Yeah? This is it. This is as good as it gets.
It can happen.
Yep.
Okay. So before we get into all the fun and defining what TAC is and all that kind of stuff, Ryan, talk to us about your service history. So you were not always a civilian. Yeah. You've got some service in your past. Can you talk me through kind of what you did in service, and then how did you get to be part of TAC personally?
I never actually wanted to be a part of TAC personally, which may sound strange, but three or four times now I have ended up either in or back in the world of TAC, and every time has been kind of more adventurous than the last. So yes, I was active duty Air Force as a developmental engineer for about 6 years, 2011 to 17. Spent that time stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, getting my master's degree in computer engineering. And then for my first, you know, real assignment, went to Air Force Research Laboratory in Rome, New York, and I really didn't want to go there. I was pretty bummed when I got the assignment. I just heard all these awful things about it. So I show up the first day, and a guy that I work with every day now, Ralph Kohler, asked me, so what do you do? And I said, well, I can code. And he's got, great. We've got this new app called ATAC. This is April 2013, and we need some more engineers on it. And so I'm like, okay, I can get down with that. I've never done Android, but like, let's give it a go. And so AFRL ended up being like the best tour that I never asked for. I never could have, you know, even wanted. So I ended up deploying to Afghanistan while I was there. Took a new UAS, a new unmanned aerial system, over to Afghanistan. We flew missions, EW missions, in support of both conventional and special operations forces for the 6 months that I was there. And it was while I was there that I kind of had my get it moment. I tell everybody that is in the TAC world, like, everybody has their got it moment with TAC. And I had mine in Afghanistan. Not that anybody there was using it really pervasively. There were a few units that were, but I was there. We were flying missions, and we had some missions where we just couldn't get timely information down to the ground force commander. And so we were doing some experimentation with some new radios that we find really common, mesh networking radios today. But there's some experimentation with putting these radios on the aircraft, because we're like, hey, if SOF is going to be using these down below, let's put the mesh network on the aircraft. And so, like, naturally ATAC follows when we're trying to get information from A to B. So got back from the stand and started prototyping this. And that just, you know, kind of one thing led to another. So that was really fun, moderately successful, and got really close to the fires community as well. Have kind of maintained just a really deep allegiance there. Not that I am, you know, a JTAC or a TACP officer or anything, but just love the guys and love, you know, working with them, because they're pipe hitters, and fires is just fun. It's really high risk, you know, any way you slice it, but it is fun and really detailed. So that's kind of what's kept me engaged in the TAC community for the past almost seven years after active duty, is just in these unsuspecting places, people have had these problems that can be solved with TAC. You know, so in one case, it was at a defense contractor I was working at. We needed to integrate ATAC with a unique fires concept on big UAS, not little ones, but big ones. So was able to stand up a new program and do some good things there. And then in my reserve capacity, I'm a flight test engineer with the Air National Guard Air Force Reserve Test Center, or AATC. Did the acronym second that time. And so they had a need to pull video over over RF into the A-10 cockpit. So from the wing into the cockpit, it was actually pretty successful. And we've gotten that capability fielded now to where the A-10s can now, you know, view video in the cockpit on an ATAC tablet. And so it's pretty cool. So now with the TAC Product Center, again, have not asked for any of these things. They've just kind of happened. I am leading the TAC Product Center. And it's a really unique organization. I think we'll get into some of that, but, yeah, basically I showed up as a federal civilian at SOCOM several years ago, and, there was a vacancy, just kind of, unexpected at the product center to lead it. So they tricked me though. They said, hey, we need to fill this gap, cause SOCOM chairs the organization, the group of offices that resource the TAC Product Center. And so it was their job to kind of fill that vacancy when it opened up. And they said, hey, welcome to PEO Soft Digital Applications, Program Executive Office Soft Digital Applications. We need someone to kind of step in and do TAC for a little bit, because we need to find a new director. I'm like, okay, yeah, like, you know, love software, love TAC, love leading. And so then, you know, 24 hours later, I was the TAC Product Center director, and I hadn't been at SOCOM, Special Operations Command, for more than a few weeks at that point. So yeah, it's just funny how it all works out. But it is a fantastic organization. These people get after it every day, and we get really, really deep with the user.
Yeah. So, hey, Ryan, so I wanted to add on to that, because I think it's extremely unique that the three individuals who were impacted by TAC software actually didn't enter it wanting to have anything to do with it. It was funny, pure because it was effective, it was convenient, and it allowed us to, like, communicate across coalition forces. We didn't even have to speak the same language. That's how good the product was. It was amazing. So yeah, as you were speaking, I was reflecting on that for a moment. I was like, that's really, really cool. Because a lot of people can like focus on a like some type of blue chip product and like, oh, I want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
But it's amazing when you all choose to be a part of something, but it's not something everyone knows. It's just like, no, this is actually really good. It's convenient, it's effective, and it meets all the marks. So I'm really excited to dive into like the development side, because I think that would immensely benefit the Marine Corps.
All right, well, I'm going to challenge you guys now, because we've got to explain this thing. We've sort of kicked around the can and beat around the bush a little bit about what is TAC. So talk to me about at a high level. And Ryan, I'll probably kick this over to you first and foremost. But you know, we know that there is the TAC, there is WinTAC, there's ATAC, there's a TAC server. Like hit me at least those four and tell me what I missed there.
Yeah, simplest, it is a family of software applications that do command and control, situational awareness, and fires. And I think that's kind of where users start. Like, they'll find out, like Steve was saying, like, it's going to be some initial experience like, oh, I can get this blue dot over to that device. And then it kind of grows from there, because there's so many things you can do with TAC. It's always been premised on modularity, extensibility. The government owns these products. There's no vendor that can assert propriety to any of these products. And so it makes them very portable as well. But yeah, fires, command and control, situational awareness.
So I think you nailed it, because we initially started the podcast with talking about command and control. And I never lead in with command and control without talking about situational awareness. Because you have to have command and control, but you have to make those decisions in context. And what ATAC did, and it's amazing, because I was watching my boys like having a blast in flag football, right? And they don't know any of the technical jargon. If like Bill Belichick like schooled them like on anything, they would fail completely. But you know what they could do? They all could like lay out their palm and like, it's like, I'm gonna go this way. You're gonna go that way, you're gonna go this way. And I'm going to throw to whoever's open, and by God, it worked. And that's, and I like the technical accomplishment of ATAC. Like I can't overstate it, but that's what it did.
Steve, did you just say it's as easy as playing backyard football because of TAC?
That is what,
that's basically what I got from you.
That is exactly what the developers did. And that is what the objective should be for everyone who's developing software for the military. Like, do not bench like your delivery of a software capability to like, oh, okay, well, we just needed training. We'll send them to this two week course. We're going to make some money on that one. Like, can a bunch of diverse folks, right, from pick your country, come up, join in on this software, and come up with a plan to accomplish the objective.
Like, gotcha. So
I'm sounding like a romantic, but Ryan, my God, you guys, like, you killed it.
Hopefully we'll keep killing it.
Well,
I like the layers of that culture statement as well, Ryan. Yeah. Well, okay. So I think that's a very bold statement, right? Like, anyone who designs military software needs to keep the lowest common denominator in mind, right? Like, non-native English speaking partner nations who we're going to be in coalition with need to be able to use this. And this gets into a lot of need to be able to use all of it, right? If you need to have a 2-week training course in order to use a piece of software, maybe you need to analyze if you've got your target audience correct in some way, shape, or form, or you're building your software to support this. I always go back, and while I am 100% an Android user and I don't use Apple software at all, I gotta give mad props to like the original iPhone and iPad. Like, it came with no instruction manual, and I never needed one to do what I needed to do. And to this day, when I use software that is not intuitive, where I have to ask myself, like, where am I supposed to click? I get like a bad like feeling in my stomach. I get like the uncanny valley of software happening where I'm like, oh, I want away from this in real time. Like, give me something that makes sense to what I want.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, so let's, this is an ATAC conversation, but that is what software was designed to do, right? Assist the human system in making good decisions. Okay. Yeah. So, like, my unit right now, we're getting ready for Phasmo. We're like, we established a Phasmo war room, bringing all the key stakeholders together to like attempt to get our records, because no one's actually told us what our records are supposed to look like, but like get an estimate of what they're supposed to look like and attempt to force the information system to make them look that way. Mm. Instead of an information system aiding us in getting to that objective. Like, it's, and I tell you, I had the MMO like walk us through how they do an acceptance service request, and I wanted to like bash my eyes in. I was like, we are really asking Marines to do this.
Like, Phasmo, Field Supply and Maintenance Analysis Office, MMO, Maintenance Management Officer.
Yeah. Ah, darn it.
Sadness incarnate. Sadness incarnate.
Where's the software to like tell me to do this? But no, exactly. It's supposed to aid us. It's not supposed to, like, we are not supposed to implement evaluation systems so that we aid the software in doing its job.
And I want to
back to ATAC.
Yeah, I want to say real quick though. So I have taught Marines every class from A plus, Net plus, Sec plus, CCNA, CCNP, even some CCIE concepts, and several other courses in English, and I feel like I was always up for the challenge, and it wasn't super difficult. I have trained a partner force not in English, and spoiler, I am not a good non-English speaker. That is a challenge. And when you're thinking through, how do I field this gear? Don't just think I am going to field this to English speakers and I'm going to have English speakers train people up on this. Like, you need to make your software easy enough to where you can teach a class through an interpreter. And that probably should be your mindset.
I always think back to traveling as well, John, and like going to the international CrossFit gym where I don't know the word for squat or deadlift or pull up or whatever. And you have to pantomime through that. And that is some like basic human movement stuff. And it still gets lost in translation often. And there's a lot of pointing and a lot of gesturing. I can't even imagine teaching an international class based on a piece of software technology using like meta concepts of technology and logic and process that don't have an in real life equivalent.
Yeah. And we have a bunch to get to. So I want to move us along here. So Ryan, real quick, can you give me the historical, like, imagine this is a PowerPoint slide and there's a timeline and there's a bunch of bullets. Like, where did baby tack start and where are we at now?
That's a great question. We've come up with those charts over the years too. They've existed, and they just get so long and they run off the slide and we just forget about them. But the real impetus for TAC was a fratricide incident in Afghanistan. I want to say it was December of 2001. So it was the U.S. Green Beret team, the ODA, Operational Detachment Alpha, that was escorting Hamid Karzai's assault force into Kandahar. And they, you know, met heavy resistance, obviously. And so they had a B-52 waiting in the overhead with bombs ready to go. And that's where we have to pause and think about the user experience on the ground. So one of the joint terminal attack controllers, JTACs on the ground, had a, now this is an acronym I don't know, the DAGR, whatever DAGR stands for, the GPS, it's a green brick with rubber buttons on it and a little tiny three-line LCD screen. And so this JTAC, responsible for calling in the airstrike from the B-52, has the target position, target coordinates dialed up on, thank you, Defense Advanced GPS Receiver. That's great. DAGR has the target coordinate dialed up on this little tiny screen, and the battery dies. So the DAGR back then, if you took the batteries out with the target coordinate up, plug the batteries back in, like you know what happens, like the friendly position comes up. And so the strike continued in the heat of battle, like just fog of war kind of stuff. And the right bomb comes off the right aircraft, called in by the right guy with what he thought was the right coordinate, but due to a poor user experience, the right bomb went to the wrong place, killed several Green Berets, severely injured the two Air Force combat controllers. And so one of those combat controllers was formally tasked, once he'd recovered as much as he could recover, he was formally tasked by the Secretary of the Air Force to go fix that problem. And so the Air Force actually created two new program offices. And so it launched a bunch of experiments, you know, new technologies. And this is like pre-smartphones. So there were no iPhones. There were PDAs. There were miniature laptops. There were systems that weighed 37 pounds. And you could have like a, you know, a 7-inch color screen with a little keyboard. But like, it, we didn't have like Androids or anything cool. So this campaign, you know, spurred many millions of dollars of investment, and nobody had really figured out like the how to do this in an effective human-centered way. Smartphones come out in like 2007. And so Air Force Research Laboratory decided, hey, we're going to see what we can do with smartphones. So long story short, they put a map on the phone and they said, hey, we can bring a radio into this and we can overlay a dot that already comes off of this radio over this proprietary interface, but we can still plot it on the phone. And so that was kind of the birth of ATAC. Back then, it was called Android Map. And so it was just Android Map. It was just the Android piece. And it was just a tactical radio. But they showed they could do this. So then, you know, you embed with users, you get feedback, and you're like, okay, we can layer this, that, and the other on top of it. So like, you know, KMLs come into it, you know, keyhole markup language, like overlays come into it. We start figuring out how to draw gridded reference graphics or GRGs, really helpful in coordinating close air support on airstrikes from the air to the ground. And so you start to see capabilities come to life. And 2011 saw the first combat deployment of ATAC. And so this is with special operations, U.S. Special Operations Forces, and they found it to be pretty effective. So they found that ATAC in that initial form actually matched up pretty well with not a requirement, but with a literal napkin sketch. There's this famous napkin sketch in the soft community where it's like, yeah, hey, we want to have like, you know, robots and like at the time, like quadcopters weren't a thing, but you know, IEDs were a big problem. Booby traps were a big thing. And so like, how can we mitigate the risk to human life? And so there, you know, they saw like, there's an opportunity for ATAC here to solve some problems for us. So they started experimenting with it. By 2014, I think we had our first technology transition out of AFRL to a program of record in SOCOM. And over the next 2 years, Big Army started to say, okay, like it's not something we made, but we could make this work for us. So you start to see the Army adopt it. You'll notice I haven't said the Air Force adopted it. The Air Force created it. The Air Force was the reason for it. The Air Force was one of the last services to adopt it. So like as an Air Force guy, that was both painful and a challenge. But that's kind of what led me to be really close to the fires community, because like all these fires focused individuals were like, I can get ATAC, I can do fires things with it. And yet my program offices are not letting me do that because the requirements are not written in such a way that mobile devices are being required to go do an Android app and go do things that are a lot more efficient. But yeah, I mean, there was just so much organizational inertia. I mean, we've been fighting organizational inertia for 15 years and we'll be fighting it for the next 15 years. Like there was a time when before ATAC was institutionalized in SOF, which, you know, today most people in SOF, unless you were around then, like you think like, oh, ATAC's like always been, you know, part of SOCOM. And it's like, well, no, not until about 10 years ago was it really a thing, a program of record that was sustained and managed that way. But like there was a time when they would say, I'll never allow an Android on the battlefield. It's like, well, okay, we'll just kind of wait for you to retire, I guess. And so sure enough, you know, Androids are on the battlefield, really very effective in bridging all these gaps with partner forces. And so we're at a state today where it's like, hey, the apps are really good. Where there's all kinds of ways we can make them better. We've always got finite capacity, but you know, it forces design decisions on our side, prioritization decisions. How do we make them better? And so we just listen to the community. We have a lot of direct user feedback that we get. We've got some very engaged users, you know, kind of experts in their domain, and they'll give us very concentrated, at times very blunt feedback. And we do our best to listen to that. And we're really well positioned to respond to that. I think in the 4.10 release cycle that is just now coming to a close with the release of 5.0, ATAC 5.0, we actually upgraded ATAC 26 times and released it through Google Play Store 26 times. Yeah. So we're at a point now of where you kind of look at, like, you know, the DORA metrics, for example, of continuous delivery and what shows whether you're like, DORA metrics, DevOps research and assessment metrics. So
let,
you look
let
at
me
like
just throw
where
out
we are
here.
Compared.
Yeah. I used to work on the team at Google that used to do all the implementation for the DORA metrics and went through that acquisition and everything. So like seeing DORA in the wild, super awesome. Makes my heart very happy. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ryan. So,
see, we were friends before I even got on this podcast. So yeah, like if you compare us to like what industry would say is a good standard for performance of a software organization, I think we can reasonably say like we've made a really heavy push over the past couple of years to automate like everything we can in that ATAC release process. But we're at a really good place now. And like, so that's not the end. Like we haven't made it. We haven't arrived. Now that we've kind of, and I say kind of because there's a lot of program offices have their own processes that kind of slow that down. But like, as far as what we can control, like deploying through Google Play Store, we've mastered that. We've mastered like that continuous delivery and deployment model. Now the next horizon is the data. And like, so now that we can really rapidly iterate on an app in production, just using ATAC as an example, now it's about how do we operationalize the data? How do we make the app smarter in the DoD environment where comms are really bad, where users get minimal training? How do we make this really critical app smarter every time a user picks it up and uses it? And that's where I'll kind of end that line of thought there. But that's like the next horizon for us.
And right. And your user base isn't just like the DoD US born citizen. It's across the globe.
Yeah. So like we release it through Google Play Store. If you look at the numbers, there's like 500,000 downloads, or I think that's combined between Apple App Store and Google Play Store, iTech and ATAC. But at any rate, hundreds of thousands of downloads. We're always really cautious to point out that does not mean like 500,000 people are running around every day with ATAC strapped to their chest or in their pocket or whatever. What that does
that
mean
we
is
know
that
of.
People are finding a reason
sure.
to download. Well, there's actually another side to that. Like we do have better numbers on the operational usage side. What we've seen is that people all over the globe will download it. And part of the reason that's possible is because it's translated into, nine other languages, nine languages, including US English. And so if you just go and set the language on your phone, on your Android device to like modern standard Arabic, there's several others. ATAC, you don't even have to restart it. Like ATAC will just swap in, you know, the right strings and make ATAC readable in your foreign language. So it's not perfect. There are some gaps in some of the languages, but it's pretty good. It's enough to be able to like sling a dot over to a partner force and they can operate ATAC in their own language.
Yeah. So I want to throw another shout out. So number one, incredibly impressive of the number of ways y'all were able to manipulate TAC and ATAC to mean several different things across all the echelons of customers y'all serve. But just to the DoD in general, like the name of your software does not have to spell out an it can actually just convey the meaning of what your application is accomplishing. So going back to it, like this is a fantastic education for me. Like, so once I got back stateside, I wanted to attempt to understand like what was I just a part of? And oh, John, wow. I know you felt the same way. Like, what was that thing that like was it was a game changer? And that's overused in so many times. it is not being overused here, but it was a game changer. So, you know, right, I do the typical thing, go to Google, type in ATAC, mm-hmm. like start looking it up. And it's fascinating to me that you said that the history of the Air Force, because like they're the ones who led the development.
Yes.
But if you could go into a little bit, because I can't remember his name, but I loved his line of challenges to his staff. And any good like product developer, they have this line of reasoning where they're no longer asking permission. They're demanding to tell for their staff to tell him what says I can't do it. Show me where it says I can't do this. Because that's of all the videos I watched, that's what resonated with me. I was like, that's someone who understands change. So Ryan, I don't know if you were a part of that, but man, if you have any part of that story, I would love to hear it.
No, I don't know anything about that story.
However, I will get with Steve and we will put this in the show notes so that you can take a look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome.
So before the podcast, we were talking about bureaucratic inertia and so anyone who knows the military, that you know that you go into the fleet and you go back to like somewhere in the ring of the Pentagon. And you go back out to the fleet, go back to the Pentagon. And the bureaucratic inertia is actually what a lot of folks in the fleet use as like, this is why we can't make things better. Grr. So frustrating. But it really takes those spirits. And this, Ryan, this is the organization you're part of challenging it. Like, actually, hold on a second, guys. No, stop. Hold on. Show me where it says that. Oh, it doesn't say that. No joke. How long have you been saying that? 5 years. That's impressive. We're moving on.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. So guys, I want to ask a quick question over to you, Ryan, on this one. So like command and control on the org chart, like, who do you work for today? How do you fit into the greater puzzle?
Yeah, it's like Inception. So I am, strictly speaking, a Naval Surface Warfare Center crane, federal civilian. Mentioned I was originally hired to be an engineer at U.S. Special Operations Command. So I do have one foot in the camp at an organization called SOF ATNL, or Special Operations Forces Acquisition Technology and Logistics. SOCOM is unique in that way. We have, as a combatant command, we actually have an acquisition authority and responsibility. So we have our own acquisition organization. And so I'm the chief engineer at PEO Soft Digital Applications, which is the software and data program office for SOCOM. We do some really, really cool stuff there. And so in that role, like, I'm not like a redline your documents kind of chief engineer. Best way I can describe it is like, I'm very, you know, passionate, I think, you know, reasonably knowledgeable about like just modern best practices for software development and delivery. And so my role there has been to kind of like come alongside program managers who are not comfortable in software development delivery and say, look, there's a better way. We can do this within the federal acquisition regulation, within the Defense Department's like planning, programming, budgeting, execution, or PPB&E cycles. These are all like huge lethargic machines that we're a part of. So my job there is to really encourage and as a fellow program manager, show them how better can be done in a technical way. I will say I spend most of my time at the Tech Product Center, so I'm like further, you know, kind of matrixed out. And so the Tech Product Center is this really ethereal organization. We don't have a unit identification code. We've not been gifted a line in the defense budget yet. But what we do is we act as the kind of capability delivery arm or half to the other half, which is probably the less known half, the Configuration Steering Board, or CSB. And so the TAC CSB is a group of DoD program offices and federal IT organizations, so non-DoD organizations. They fund us. They're how we exist. We have about an $11 million budget this year, this fiscal year. And we do everything from hosting tech.gov to doing the development of the products themselves, to managing the foreign military sales cases. We do all that in a fairly self-contained manner. We get a lot of support from the Army's, the other unsung hero here is the Army's C5 ISR Center organization under Army's Development Command, or DEVCOM. And so they give us a lot of like back office support, you know, finance, contracting help. But for the most part, we're a self-contained organization. That is the organization that I lead, the TAC Product Center. And it's about 27 people. 10 of us exist to keep the gears turning and greased. The other 17 are pure engineers. So people working in product, shipping product every day. But it's a fairly small organization.
And a couple following questions there. So number one, are Marines authorized to use this? And number two, if they happen to use it and they're struggling and they need a little bit help, is there anybody who can help them, and is that paid for?
The first organization that I would point any Marine to is Marine Corps Tactical Systems Support Activity, or MCTISA. So just, you know, here this week, MCTISA is on the TAC Configuration Steering Board. They're one of our bill payers. And they're kind of the focal point. So MARCOR SysCom designated MCTISA to be the Marine Corps' voice in the TAC community. As the Marine Corps is figuring out, like, how do we transition from some older programs into the TAC world? What does that look like? So MCTISA is kind of is holding the baton for that. And so that is the Marines' first stop for anything TAC.
Excellent. So that leads me into the next question that everybody is going to want to know. So we've taken JADC2 and we've added a C to it. So that is combined joint ADC2. And so inside of there, how does TAC fit? Does TAC fit maybe a little bit? Does it fit not at all? Have you had any of those conversations? Is there a JADC2 brunch that you all have?
That's funny. I wish there was a brunch for JADC2. If there is, we haven't been invited to it. So we complement JADC2 really well. And I think as you look across the JADC2 space, the CJADC2 space, or people even tack a P onto the end for partner. So if you look at the CJADC2 space, you find that TAC is actually everywhere in the CJADC2 space. It's just never called that. You know, there's people don't say like TAC, T-A-K, C2. It's just we have this C2 information system, and TAC happens to be a part of it. So we're engaged with a lot of efforts across the services right now. Like, you know, we're not ones that take on like projects for DOD organizations. What we do is maybe provide a little bit of consulting, best practices, architectural recommendations, and then we just let people run with the TAC products. We don't write authorization to operate or ATOs for people. We don't do certifications for people. We don't do like public affairs approvals for people. We make the products better every release, and we make the products available. And so I'll go a step further. It's kind of like the Kubernetes model. Like Google doesn't come like admin Kubernetes for you, or the CNCF, the Cloud Native Compute Foundation, they don't come admin Kubernetes for you. They make it available. We're kind of the same way. Like we make TAC available. And if you're going to go run or institutionalize any part of TAC, well, then fine. Do that.
All right. So I'm going to pose this question to the both of you. And I realize I'm going to lead the witness a little bit on here. But how does this all lead into software factories? Choose your branch of service. Are you supportive of them? What is their role as far as you are concerned? Do they interact with this methodology in any way? Ryan, I'm going to start with you first. And then Steve, I want you to come in with the heat.
So I launched a software factory for the Air Force. I had gone back on orders for about 6 months, right before COVID began, actually. So as Platform One was coming of age, as the Air Force was figuring out, yeah, we need like all these domain-specific software factories that are not bound by a requirement, we started a software factory at my own organization. I think what I learned there and have continued to observe in the DoD software factory ecosystem is one, it's I guess there's two things that I've learned. One is it doesn't happen without all these incredible American patriots who just want to see software done better in the DoD. And there are so many ways that we just make it so hard to do that. And all these people deserve so much admiration. The second thing I've learned is that every one of these factories is very, very domain specific. And we can embrace that or we can try to squash the domain specificity and say there can only be one software factory for, you know, these increasingly broader domains. The domains that these software factories serve are so many, like they're so varied. And I think our position from the TAC community, and we've worked with several of them at this point, and they've all been positive engagements. It's like, hey, like we're going to lean in, you're going to lean in, and we're going to figure out how TAC works in your domain. And like, frankly, like some of these, like there's not a domain fit, and some of these there is a domain fit. I'll say that like Army Software Factory has taken the TAC products, and they kind of saw a gap where some of the more advanced or newer concepts of employment in the Army demand a much more rapid approach to software delivery. And it's not that there are like there aren't program offices in the Army that care about this. There are some program offices like PM Soldier Warrior on the Army side under PEO Soldier, or PM Mission Command under PEO C3T, and they're doing a great job with the TAC software, extending it in new and novel ways. But there are policies that really hold them back from pivoting quickly. And so that's kind of the gap that Army Software Factory found. They said, hey, we can take our new and novel method of operation at Army Software Factory. We're going to apply that to soldier level problems that are not specified in a requirement. That's one of the big things, is like they can't work to a requirement. And hey, guess what? Like we've never had a requirement. And so we work really well together in that regard. And they're able to take TAC and apply it to soldier level problems. And if you look at TAC Product Center through the lens of team topologies, we're like through and through a platform team comprised of multiple streamlined teams and our own platform team. So we exist to make the products available. We exist to make plugin development easy and release easy, as easy as possible, so that the organization, especially these software factories, can accelerate the pace of capability delivery in those very niche domains where they exist.
Okay, so when you say software factory to me, and Ryan led with this, and it was laid out throughout the podcast, but it started off with the user. And so many of our capability development systems don't start there. They start with folks who are far removed from the problem and are trying to guess. So you walk into, whether it's the Army Software Factory or the newly established Marine Corps Software Factory, they always start with the user. Like, okay, however many degrees you are removed from the problem, awesome. Where do you think there's a problem? And then they go directly to the user who's having to experience the issue and resolve it. So when you say software factory, right, that's just a term, like, sweet, awesome. That's what the DoD is using today. But as long as I hear the focus on the user story as it's defined in resolving an issue, like money, that's where you're getting it. Ultimately, like with John and I, that's where ATAC killed it. Like, started with the user. What do you need to do? Whether you're just a bunch of adolescent boys on a flag football team, like trying to scheme up a play that you're going to do, and none of you have a common terminology, or maybe you're in a far off distant desert and you're having to communicate with a bunch of folks who English is not their first language, but you know what's super easy? Red's bad.
Red is bad.
Put it where they are and it goes kaboom. Like, everyone understands that. It's amazing. So I'm incredibly enthusiastic about what Lieutenant Colonel Bach is doing with the Marine Corps Software Factory. Yeah. I had a conversation with them today. But okay. What they're all going towards is like focus on what is not 4, 5, 6 degrees removed from the people who are actually doing the work. Hold on. What is the work they are trying to do? What is the problem that they are actually faced with? I want to do, it might be a software solution. It may not be. It may just be a policy maneuver, right? That's the biggest mistake we make. It was like, oh, it needs to be solved by software. More than likely, it's software and policy together. more than like.
Well, so like there are so many small problems, like all these little muscles that we never work out, and so many small problems that it's just like overlooked. And I think like that's somewhere that that TAC can probably like very humbly shine in the coming years. Like, what are all these little bits of these little like kind of updates that we're trying to get here and there? Like one example is like the fuel farms on military bases. Like one example of how like knowing fuel status at any Air Force base in the Pacific, let's say, can, you know, status its fuel to everybody is like, well, you can way overcomplicate this and, you know, do some, you know, computer vision machine learning thing that says, well, the round gauge on the fuel tank reads this, and we're going to like stream that up to, you know, the base network. Or you can just like send the airmen out there and have the airmen, you know, punch in the number off the fuel gauge on the big fuel tank that's been there for 50 years or however long, and is not going to change, and like populate that over TAC. And like that little bitty number can very easily and seamlessly be propagated out to a whole theater so that the F-18 four-ship that needs a place to land and gas up, not even an Air Force entity, like they have a better idea of places they need to go. So it's like, all these little tiny problems that a requirement's never going to be made for. It's like, well, how about we just use this requirement less, so to speak, app, or family of apps to give airmen, soldiers, sailors, Marines the ability to go solve problems. And I think that's where we're going to see TAC used more and more is these innovation cells, individual developers. Like, you don't need a standing army. You need people who know how to code, who are confident and confident in the ability to do so, and arm them with tools like TAC. There are other tools like TAC. Give them the right tools, and they're just going to go solve these problems that keep us from moving a lot faster than we could at the big level.
So Ryan, I know we're short on time here. 30 seconds or less. Can you give me, what should I be excited about in the 5.x release?
Okay. So 5.0 is going to hit the streets soon. And the biggest thing that you're going to see is MIL standard 2525 Delta multi-point graphics. That's going to be a game changer because we've never done that. So like TAC has really been focused a lot over the past 15 years on like the special operations forces, counterterrorism missions. And we just haven't been doing these big force on force maneuvers. When we get into large scale combat operations, we need a much richer set of well-defined standardized graphics. So we put a lot of work into multi-point graphics. We prototyped it actively with real users in combat today. And you're going to see a new capability surface in TAC. I'm going to go a step beyond that too, but in TAC 5.1, which will come out in March, and then 5.2, like you're going to see us put a renewed emphasis on fires. Fires today, again, very soft and CT centric. Fires are evolving now in TAC. And so we've got a big opportunity. I'm super excited about it. Fires in TAC are going to be retooled, re-engineered with users, senior experts from the fires communities across the four services. Fires are going to be really, really cool in TAC in the next 6 to 12 months, which may be when we need it to be really cool.
Kyle, you're welcome for teeing you up for the easiest hot take ever.
This is a toughie because we've had a lot of good stuff on this, but I am going to come back and say, anyone developing software for the DoD, please make it easy to use. I don't think that is a humongous ask, but it is incredibly difficult. Anyone who's listening to this cast that has never had to build software for a user, it is so easy to Monday morning quarterback this stuff, right? Like even the most basic thing that you think is so simple, get someone outside of your field to have to do it and make them go through an interface that you built. I promise the baby will always be ugly and you will be unable to accept it. And it's hard as heck to do. Software is hard, y'all. But again, software is amazing and can solve incredibly complex problems as long as you have a holistic look at it. So be intention filled with what you do and realize that just because someone says this is always how we've done it, that should be motivation for you to say, well, there's got to be a better way now.
Dear listeners, thanks for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at USMC underscore TFPHOENIX. That's at USMC underscore Task Force Phoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and giving us that coveted 5-star review and accompanying comment. And with that, we are out.